However, now, first and foremost, a rare treat for all of us as Clive Staples Lewis makes his seminary debut. The writings of this prolific author and teacher are certainly well known around the world. Among his nearly 40 volumes are works as broad on as broad a scale as the Narnia books for children you may be familiar with, volumes on literary criticism of English literature, that is, science fiction, the space trilogy, Out of the Silent Planet, Perelandra, That Hideous Strength. But probably among his many volumes on the Christian faith, two of the best known are perhaps the Screwtape Letters, which were originally published in the now defunct English periodical called Guardian, and were presented to an American generation just slightly older than I am by means of the Saturday Evening Post. And the other, of course, is the volume entitled Mere Christianity, which was originally presented as radio talks and later published in three small volumes entitled The Case for Christianity, Christian Behavior, and Beyond Personality, an Introduction to the Doctrine of the Holy Trinity. It will be from that volume that we'll be hearing excerpts this morning. Although C.S. Lewis died in 1963, Americans learned of his death in a rather belated way, for the same day that this famous Irish Englishman died in Oxford, England, in November of 1963, a famous Irish American by the name of John Fitzgerald Kennedy was dying en route to a hospital in Dallas, Texas. In fact, they died within hours of each other, and the only U.S. paper to pick up the UP wire announcing Lewis' death was the New York Times, where there was a one-sentence obituary appeared somewhere near the bottom of the 14th page or thereabouts. But he is back with us alive and well this morning in the person of Hannibal Friedrich, and as the announcements have said, you loved him as Luther, you welcomed him back as C.F.W. Walther, and now can meet him in excerpts from Mere Christianity. So help me welcome, if you will, the noted scholar, author, and Christian apologist, C.S. Lewis.
Morning. My name is Clive Staples Lewis. I go by C.S. because when I was a young man, my name made me the target for many bullies. That and the fact that I was a coward. I would quickly desert any situation which proved that it might be to my bloodshed. And one of my friends informed me, he said, Clive, everyone is calling you a sissy. And I said, I would rather have them say, oh, look at the sissy run, than doesn't he look natural? I do warn you, I offer no help to anyone who is hesitating between two Christian denominations. You will not learn from me whether you ought to be an Anglican, a Methodist, a Presbyterian, or a Roman Catholic. The omission is intentional. There is no mystery about my own position. I am a very ordinary layman in the Church of England. However, I do not try to convert anyone to my position. Ever since I became a Christian, I have felt that the best, perhaps the only service that I could render to my unbelieving neighbors, was to explain and defend the beliefs that have been common to nearly all Christians at all times, what Baxter calls mere Christianity. This is my only motive, and I should be very happy if people would not draw fanciful inferences from my silence on certain disputed matters. I do not wish to expound anything that could be called my religion. I only wish to expound mere Christianity, which is what it is and was what it was long before I was born, whether I like it or not. Also, I hope that no one supposes that mere Christianity is here put forward as an alternative to the creeds of the existing communion, as if a man could adopt it in preference to Congregationalism or Greek Orthodoxy or anything else. It's more like a hall, out of which doors open into several rooms. If I can bring anyone into the hall, I have done all that I have attempted. But it is in the rooms and not in the hall where one will find meals and chairs and fires. The hall is a place to wait in. It is not a place to live in. And it's for this reason, I suppose, that I believe that even the worst of these rooms is preferable to none at all. Above all, the individual must be asking himself, which door is the true one? Which room has the true teachings, and not which one pleases it most because of its paint or paneling? When you have reached your own room, please be kind to those who may have chosen a different door. If they are wrong, they need your prayers all the more. If they are your enemies, then you are under orders to pray for them. That is one of the rules that is common to the entire house. Now let us begin to scratch the surface of mere Christianity by discussing the three parts of Christian morality. There's a story about a schoolboy who was asked what he thought God was like. And he replied that as far as he could make out, God was the sort of person who went snooping round to see if anyone was having any fun, and then he would try to put a stop to it. I am afraid that that is the idea that the word morality raises in a good many people's minds. Something that interferes. Something that prevents us from having a good time. But in reality, moral rules are directions for running the human machine. Every moral rule is there to prevent a breakdown or a strain in the running of this machine. That is why at first it seems to always be interfering with our natural inclinations. Whenever we are learning how to operate a machine, the instructor may say, no, don't do it that way, because of course all sorts of things may look all right, but they will not really work at all. Now, there are two ways in which the human machine goes wrong. One is when human individuals either drift apart from one another or else collide with one another and do one another damage. The other is when the different parts of a man, his different faculties and desires and so forth, either drift apart or else collide with one another. You can get the idea plain if you think of us as a fleet of ships sailing in a formation. The only way that the voyage is going to be a success is if, in the first place, the ships do not run into one another and cause one another damage. And secondly, if each ship is seaworthy and has her engines in good running order. Or if you prefer, you can think of humanity as a band trying to play a tune. To get a good result, you need two things. Each player's individual instrument must be in tune, and each player must come in at the proper moment so as to combine with all the others. There is one thing we have not yet taken into account. We have not asked ourselves where the fleet is trying to sail to, or what piece of music the band is trying to play. Because every instrument may be in tune, and all the players may come in at the right moment. But the performance would not be a success if they had been engaged to play dance music and actually perform nothing but funeral dirges. And the fleet, the voyage may go very well, and yet it would be a failure if they were supposed to arrive in New York and actually arrive in Calcutta. Morality, then, does seem to be concerned with three things. First, fair play and harmony between individuals, man and man. Secondly, with what might be called tidying up or the harmonizing of the individual himself. And thirdly, the general purpose of mankind as a whole, what man was made for. Now, modern people dwell considerably on the first part of morality, man and man, but they almost totally disregard the second and the third parts of morality. In our newspapers, when they speak of Christian virtues and values, they are almost always referring to fair play between individuals or between nations. And of course, there is the modern phrase that men use now, well, I can do such and such because it will not harm anybody else. You see that he is referring to the first part of morality, and he has quite easily forgotten about the second part, keeping his own ship in good running order, or the third part, why God created him. You see that there is some deception that is taking place, and I do believe that this deception has sources other than within man himself. Permit me to read a selection from Screwtape Proposes a Toast. Screwtape, as you know, is a senior devil. The scene is set in hell at the annual dinner of the Tempter's Training College for Young Devils. The principal, Dr. Slumgob, has just proposed the health of the guest, and Screwtape, a very experienced devil who is the guest of honor, rises to reply. Mr. Principal, your eminence, your disgraces, my thorns, shadies, and gentle devils. It is customary on these occasions for the speaker to address himself chiefly to those among you who have just graduated and who will soon be posted to official temptorships on earth. It is a custom I willingly obey. I will remember with what trepidation I awaited my own first appointment. I hope and believe that each one of you has the same uneasiness tonight. Your career is before you. Hell expects and demands that it should be, as mine was, one of unbroken success. Your dreaded principal has included in his speech something like an apology for the banquet which he has set before us. Gentle devils, no one blames him. But we must admit that the human souls on whose anguish we have been feasting tonight were of pretty poor quality. Not all the skillful cookery of our tormentors could make them better than insipid. Oh, to get one's teeth again into a Henry an Eighth or a Hitler. There was real crackling there, something to crunch, a rage, an egotism, a cruelty only just less robust than our own. Instead of this, what have we had tonight? There was a municipal authority with graft thoughts, but personally I could not detect in him the flavor of a really passionate and brutal avarice such as delighted one in the great tycoons of the last century. Was he not unmistakably a little man, a grubby little non-entity who had drifted into corruption chiefly because everyone else did it? Then there was the lukewarm casserole of adulterers. Could you find in it any trace of a fully inflamed, defiant, rebellious, insatiable lust? I couldn't. They all tasted to me like undersexed morons who had blundered or trickled into the wrong bed in automatic response to sexy advertisements or to make themselves feel modern and emancipated or to reassure themselves about their virility and their normalcy, or even because they had nothing else to do. Frankly, to me, who has tasted Casanova, they were nauseated. The trade unionist, stuffed with sedition, was perhaps a shade better. He had done some real harm. He had, not quite unknowingly, worked for bloodshed, famine, and the extinction of liberty. But now comes the point. Gastronomically, all this is deplorable. But I hope none of us put gastronomy first. Hell forbid. Is it not, in another and far more serious way, full of hope and promise? Consider first the mere quantity. The quality may be wretched, but we never had souls in more abundance. And then the triumph. We are tempted to say that such souls are hardly worth damning. Yes, but the enemy, for whatever inscrutable and perverse reason, thought them worth trying to save. Believe me, he did. You youngsters who have not yet been on active service have no idea with what labor, with what delicate skill, each of these miserable creatures was finally captured. The creatures do not understand either the source or the real character of the prohibitions they are breaking. Their consciousness hardly exists apart from the social atmosphere that surrounds them. And of course, we have contrived that their very language should be all smudge and blur. What would be a bribe in someone else's profession is a tip or a present in theirs. The job of the tempters was first, of course, to harden these choices of the hellward roads into a habit by steady repetition, but then to turn the habit into a principle that the creature is prepared to defend. After that, all will go well. Conformity to the social environment now becomes an unacknowledged creed. Mere ignorance of the law they break now turns into a vague theory about it, a theory expressed by calling it conventional or Puritan or bourgeois morality. These, then, are two welcome phenomena. First, the abundance of our capture. However tasteless our fare, we are in no danger of famine. And secondly, the triumph. The skill of our tempter has never stood higher. And therefore, I propose a toast to your disgraces, shadies, and gentle doubles as I give you Principal Slubgob and the College. Now, it seemed to me that in dividing morality into three separate parts, we were able to cover the ground very simply. But there is also another way to cover this ground, and that is the way that was used by the old writers. They had a longer scheme which included seven virtues. According to them, four of these were called cardinal virtues, and the remaining three were called theological. The cardinal virtues were those which all civilized people recognized, and the theological were those which, as a rule, only Christians know about. We can deal with the theological at some other time. Let us now take up these four cardinal virtues. And here the word cardinal has nothing to do with the cardinals of the Roman Catholic Church. The word simply means the hinge of a door, and the old writers were stating that these virtues were pivotal. They were the virtues of prudence, temperance, justice, and fortitude. Prudence meant practical common sense, taking the time to think about what you are doing and what was likely to come of it. Nowadays, most people hardly consider prudence to be a virtue. In fact, since our Lord said that the only way we could enter his world was by being like children, many people believe that as long as you are good, it doesn't matter whether or not you are a fool. But this is a misunderstanding. In the first place, children show plenty of prudence about things which interest them. And in the second place, as St. Paul points out, our Lord never meant that we were supposed to be like children in intelligence. On the contrary, he told us to be as wise as serpents. He wants us to have a child's heart, a child's faith, but he also wants us to have a grown-up head. The mere fact that you are talking about God does not mean that you should be satisfied with the same babyish ideas you had when you were 5 years old. Now, God will not love you any the less, or he will not have any less use for you if you happen to have been born with a very second-rate brain. He has room for people with very little sense. But he wants all his people to use what sense they have. Now, as you know, being a Christian means that you are embarking on something that is going to take the whole of you, brains and all. And it is remarkable that it also works in reverse, that being a Christian, you find out that Christianity is an education in itself. Temperance is, unfortunately, one of those words which has changed its meaning. It now means teetotalism. But in the days when the writers christened the second cardinal virtue as temperance, it meant nothing of the sort. Temperance did not refer especially to drink, and it did not mean that you abstained, but that you took all of your pleasures and only went the right length with them and no further. It is a mistake to believe that Christians should be teetotalers. Christianity is not a teetotal religion. Now, of course, a particular Christian at a particular time may have a good reason for abstaining from strong drink, either because he is the sort of man who cannot drink at all without drinking too much, or else because he wants to give his money to the poor, or because he may be in the presence of friends who are inclined to drunkenness and he does not wish to encourage them by drinking himself. But the point of the whole thing is that he is abstaining for a good reason from something which he himself does not condemn and which he enjoys other people enjoying. It is the mark of a bad man that he cannot give up anything himself without wanting everybody else to give it up also. That is not the Christian way. Christians may have reasons under specific circumstances for abstaining from all sorts of things, marriage or meat or beer or the cinema. But the moment that he begins to believe that these things are evil in and of themselves, or the moment that he begins to look down his nose at other people who are enjoying them, then he has taken a wrong turn. One great piece of mischief has been done by the modern restriction of the word temperance to the matter of drink. It helps people to forget that you can be intemperate in all sorts of things. The man who makes golf or his motorcycle the center of his life, the woman who devotes all of her thoughts to clothes or bridge or her dog, is being just as intemperate as the man who gets drunk every night. Of course, it doesn't show as easily because bridge and golf do not make you fall down in the middle of the road. But God is not fooled by the external. Justice, the third cardinal virtue, means much more than the sort of thing that goes on in our law courts. It is the old name for everything that we should now call fairness. It includes honesty, give and take, keeping your promises, so on and so forth. And the fourth cardinal virtue, that of fortitude, means both kinds of courage. That is, willing to stick something out in the face of danger and also willing to stick it out under pain. Guts, unfortunately, is perhaps the best modern English word. Now you will see that you will not be able to do very much with the other virtues, cardinal or theological, which is faith, hope, and charity, unless you bring fortitude into play. We must have the fortitude to be able to hold on to those things which we believe, to not succumb to social pressure, to not say that we are going to do something merely because everybody else is doing it, or to say that we are going to start believing something because someone proclaims that it is infantile or foolish. In the great divorce, I have a bishop, an apostate, who is one of many who has taken a bus trip from hell to the outer regions of heaven. Now, this is not a treatise on the afterlife. It is a fantasy, but a fantasy which does indeed believe in real heaven and real hell. When the bishop is there in the outer regions of heaven for his visit, he sees a former student, one in whom he had many discussions concerning theology. "My dear boy, I'm delighted to see you. Well, it's obvious by now, isn't it, that you were not quite right. My dear boy, you were coming to believe in a literal heaven and hell." The boy answered, "But wasn't I right?" "Oh, in a spiritual sense, to be sure, but nothing superstitious or mythological." "Excuse me," the boy said, "where do you imagine you have been?" "Ah, I see," the bishop responded. "You mean the gray town with its continual hope of dawn. Well, now that you mention it, I don't think we ever do give it a name. What do you call it?" "We call it hell." "There is no need to be profane, my dear boy." "I may not be very orthodox in your sense of that word, but I do feel that these matters ought to be discussed simply and seriously and reverently." Well, then the young boy proposes that the bishop should stay in the outer regions of heaven and begin to adopt himself to the heavenly region, to which the bishop replies, "Of course, I should require some assurances about this place. I should want a guarantee that you are taking me to a place where I shall find a wider sphere of usefulness and scope for the talents that God has given me and an atmosphere of free inquiry." "No," said the boy, "I can promise you none of these things. No sphere of usefulness. You are not needed there at all. No scope for your talents, only forgiveness for having perverted them. No atmosphere of inquiry, for I will bring you to the land not of questions, but of answers, and you shall see the face of God." "Ah," said the bishop, "but we must all interpret those beautiful words in our own way. For me, there is no such thing as a final answer. The free wind of inquiry must always continue to blow through the mind. Which reminds me, I can't come with you, my dear boy. I have to be back next Friday to read a paper. We have a little theological society down there. There is plenty of intellectual life. And I feel that I can do a great work among them." "But, my dear boy, you have not asked me what my paper is about. I'm taking the text about growing up to the measure of the stature of Christ and working out an idea which I feel sure you'll be interested in. I'm going to point out how people always forget that Jesus was a comparatively young man when he died. He would have outgrown some of his earlier views, you know, if he had lived. I am going to ask my audience to consider what his mature views would have been. Profoundly interesting question, don't you think? What a different Christianity we might have had if only the founder had reached his full stature. I shall end up by pointing how this deepens the significance of the crucifixion. One feels for the first time what a disaster it was, what a tragic waste, so much promise cut short. Well, must you be going, my dear boy? Well, so must I. Goodbye. It has been a great pleasure, most stimulating and provocative. And at that, the ghost nodded his head and went on with a smile, humming softly to himself, City of God, how broad and far. The first thing to get clear about Christian morality between man and man is that in this department, Christ did not come to preach any new morality. The golden rule of the New Testament, do as you would be done by, is a summing up of what everybody knows to be true. Really great moral teachers never do introduce new morality. Only the quacks and the cranks do that. As one dear professor has said, people need to be reminded more often than they need to be instructed. In the second place, let us not believe that Christianity has a detailed political program for carrying out the golden rule at any given time. It could not. For the golden rule applies to all generations and all places, and there could not be a specific way of fulfilling it that would not violate some future or some other place. So we must come to the conclusion that what we have is not a detailed political program. Christianity does not operate that way. When we are told to feed the hungry, we are not given lessons in cookery. Or when we are told to read the scriptures, we are not given lessons in Greek or Hebrew, not even in English grammar. And a third point I should like to make deals Christian morality, man and man, in the area of sex. This is most frequently a disputed topic, one which has come to the forefront very recently. Christian morality dealing with sex can be summed up in the Christian virtue of chastity. And there's no way around it. This is the most unpopular of all the Christian virtues. The rule is very simple. Either marriage with complete faithfulness to your partner or else total abstinence. Now this is so difficult and so contrary to our natural inclinations that obviously either Christianity is wrong or else our sexual instincts as they stand now have gone wrong. Being a Christian, of course, I believe that it is the instinct which has gone wrong, and I have reasons for thinking so. The biological purpose of sex is to have children. This is the biological purpose of eating, is to nourish and to keep our bodies going. Now, it is quite true that most of us, if we were permitted to eat whenever we wanted and whatever we wanted, most of us would eat too much, but not terribly so. A man may eat enough for two, but he will not eat enough for 10. The appetite goes a little bit beyond its biological purpose, but not tremendously so. Now, if you were to take a young man and allow him to satisfy his sexual appetite whenever he felt the urge, with as many women as he wanted to, and if each act produced a child, in no time at all he could populate a village. This is a ludicrous and preposterous excess of the appetite in relation to the biological purpose of sex. Or we can look at it another way. It is not difficult at all to gather a large crowd for a striptease show. That is, to watch a girly take her clothes off on a stage. Now, suppose you were to travel to a country where you could fill a theater simply by bringing out a covered plate, and that you would slowly remove the cover so that everyone would see, just as the lights went out, that it was a pork chop. Would you not feel that there was something terribly wrong with their appetite concerning food. In the same way, don't you think that someone from another country or another world might think that there is something equally queer about our appetite for sex? Now, if anyone says that sex is in itself bad, Christianity immediately contradicts him. There is no religion which supports and exalts marriage as much as Christianity, and nearly all of the great love poems have been written by Christians. Now, those who in our age are saying that there is nothing wrong with sex are right. But if they mean that there is nothing wrong with our sexual instinct as it stands, then they are wrong. But one thing we must emphasize is that Christian morality is not centered on sex. It is a sin, but it is not the worst sin. For there are spiritual sins which are much worse, backbiting and attempting to dominate others, gossiping, so on and so forth. So we see that in reality, a cold, self-righteous prig may be quite closer to hell than a prostitute. But of course, it's better to be neither. Now, as my conclusion, allow me to read a poem that I have written, which I entitled The Apologist's Evening Prayer. From all my lame defeats and oh much more, from all the victories that I seem to score, from cleverness shot forth on thy behalf, at which, while angels weep, the audience laughs. From all my proofs of thy divinity, thou who wouldst give no sign, deliver me. Lord of the narrow gate and the needle's eye, take from me all my trumpery, lest I die. Thank you for your attention.